I'm Erin.
And I'm McKenna.
And together we're the Daily Profcast.
We're two long-distance besties
who share a love of Harry Potter.
We hope you enjoyed the episode.
Welcome back to the Daily Profcast. On this episode, we're going to be finishing up our series on Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. And we'll be starting at Chapter 12 today and going all the way through Chapter 17. We're picking up at one of my favorite chapters of the book, which is the mirror.
You say that for
I do say that for everyone. They're all good.
They are all good.
But more importantly, yeah. J.K. Rowling has said that this is her favorite chapter of the book and possibly the entire series. Yeah. But it was written not too long after the death of her own mother, which heavily influenced this chapter particularly.
Wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
It's very sweet. This chapter is very endearing. This is the first time that Harry gets to have a proper Christmas.
Which is amazing. Know?
He's finally out of, honestly, his abusive living situation, well, for the school year. And he's shocked that there are presents for him. And not only one, there's multiple. The people who have just come into his life during the first, you know, part of the term are giving him presents and just want to show him that they love him, which is so sweet.
Something that rereading I thought was quite funny. It says the lake froze solid and the Weasley twins were punished for bewitching several snowballs so that they followed Quirrell around, bouncing off the back of his turban. Which, if you think that what's going on the back of Quirrell's turban right now, Fred and George are just firing shots at Voldemort.
Incredible.
Unbeknownst to them, which is so awesome.
Kicking it off. It's winter. The twins are throwing snowballs at Quirrell. Hagrid is nursing the owls back to health. Sweet Hagrid. I completely forgot about Madame Pince. Is that awful? She's not portrayed in the movies. So I read that name and I was like, oh my gosh. Hello. Harry has elected to stay at Hogwarts over the holidays. So students can either choose to go home on the Hogwarts Express for their holidays or stay in the castle.
Ron is also staying.
And what a blessing that is, that Harry gets to spend Christmas with one person that he loves. He has a reason. It's because
his parents are going to visit Charlie.
Do we think Ron would have stayed anyway with Harry or invited him home or something?
I think Ron might have invited him home. But I don't get this great feeling that Ron understands totally the significance he plays in Harry's life as like not Harry's yet, maybe, only yeah. friend.
Maybe he starts to get it on Christmas morning when Harry says, I've got presents. And Ron's like, of course you've got presents at Christmas. But he probably remembers, oh, he lived with his awful Muggle family who, not that Muggles don't do presents, but the Dursleys are just particularly horrible.
He gets a couple different presents. He gets a flute from Hagrid.
Which is so important later, and it's so sweet. It says it's hand-carved.
Imagine Hagrid's giant hands whittling a flute for a small boy.
Hagrid makes such an effort to make Harry feel loved and appreciated and welcome at Hogwarts, and it makes me want to cry. It's so sweet. He spent time hand-carving something for Harry. It's so sweet.
And I love that Aunt Petunia and Uncle Vernon send a little gift of 50 pence.
Thank you. We should talk about what Mrs. Weasley gives them.
She sends one of her famous Molly Weasley knitted sweaters.
Sort of solidifying that Harry, even though she only spent a little bit of time with him on the platform, Harry is like one of the Weasley kids.
He gets chocolate frogs from Hermione.
Right.
And then finally, the best gift of all, he gets his father's invisibility cloak.
Just casually handing off one of the Deathly Hallows to an 11-year-old.
So, do we think there's more than one invisibility cloak? Have you done any research on this?
I haven't. That's a really good question. JK makes it seem like there's not. Before James was killed, he gave it to Dumbledore to study. Could Dumbledore have gotten one somewhere else to study?
So Ron says
they're really rare, right?
In the chapter, he says, it's an invisibility cloak. So it's something he recognizes. That's and then true. He says, I'd give anything for one of those. Anything. So that tells me that there might be more than one, but I have a feeling it's a lore kind of a thing where
yeah, maybe
you know they exist, but you don't really know people who are rich enough to have them. Well, sort of how I feel about Teslas.
That's so funny. Remember, like, Ron grew up with his mother reading him Beetle the Bard.
Right.
So maybe that's where he has his knowledge of them. But you would think he would immediately say, that is the invisibility cloak. So maybe you're right. Dumbledore gives Harry the invisibility cloak. He says, use it well. We don't know that it's Dumbledore yet, but we kind of do, but we don't. It's been in his possession for all this time. Dumbledore is such an enabler, and it becomes problematic in the series. I love Dumbledore, but also I'm like, Dumbledore, that was bad.
Just like as an educator, that's probably not what you want to be doing, encouraging your students to put on an invisibility cloak and walk the halls at night.
He might as well have just given Harry a key to every, like a magic key that opens any room in the castle.
Enjoy. Then Fred and George come in with their sweaters, and Prissy little Percy won't put his on. Fred and George, something I just love is they say to him, you're not sitting with the prefects today. Christmas is a time for family. Aww. And then they all sit together in the Great Hall for a feast, which is like unlike anything Harry's ever experienced. And he's sitting with the Weasleys. So Christmas is a time for family. And he finally has one.
Can you imagine seeing Christmas at Hogwarts? I can't even fathom how glorious that would. Christmas is my favorite holiday, personally. I cannot even fathom how amazing that would be. I can hear the music in my head as I'm talking about it. But
I told Mike the other day, I would sell every earthly possession and both of my kidneys if I could just go to Hogwarts for a week.
Like, honestly.
So the other sort of layer to all of this is that Harry and Ron have been looking for Nicholas Flamel.
Yeah.
In the library for anything to do with Nicholas Flamel.
Correct.
Hermione sort of tasked them to find
keep looking
who he is and what he is all about.
Which, she, you know, Hermione's the one that will put in the work to go to the library and look. Something tells me that Ron and Harry would just forget and also not.
Later that night, Harry finally has some time to himself. And he takes his invisibility cloak and goes for a little explore.
Yeah, he does an explore. I do think it's kind of sweet that he wants to share it with Ron, but this is his first time with his dad's cloak. I don't know that he's come into possession of anything that belonged to his parents up until
now. No, the first thing that we really know that he has, I can just say that I really sympathize to that feeling because I'm adopted and my biological mother has passed away, but the first time I got one of her possessions, it was like such a, almost like an out-of-body weird experience.
Wow.
To feel you have a piece of somebody
who
you've never like really known before. And of course, I mean, Harry was separated from his parents at the same time I was separated from my mom. So when you're a baby, you just don't, you know them, but you don't know them.
Yeah.
I can just imagine how incredible that feels. But then also to have such a weird object. He's just constantly amazed at what magic is all about. Could you just imagine him imagining his dad running around Hogwarts with that and what he got up to? And
I love some of the like headcanons that people have come up with for stuff that the Marauders did with this invisibility cloak. It just makes me happy, but I'm a Marauders stan.
Harry like takes it out for a little spin and goes to the restricted section of the library where he hasn't been able to go before, which Mike and I were having this discussion the other day. Why is there a restricted section of the library? Why isn't it not better kept away if you really don't want anybody going back there?
Yeah, or enchanted or something. Dumbledore. It is for the professor's use, and there's a lot of dark magic books back there.
Yeah, I mean, you're just telling me Albus Dumbledore like couldn't have created some sort of charm or system to keep the kid
an down. Age line. Literally, he does an age line for the Goblet of Fire. Could he not have done the same for the restricted section?
But upperclassmen.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
With if you have professor's permission, you're allowed to go back there.
Is it Peeves who comes and like rats him out? Probably.
He sees Professor Snape and Filch having a conversation. where Filch says, "You told me to come directly to you and tell you if I thought anyone was wandering around at night and somebody's been in the library in the restricted zone."
Which further makes us suspect Snape of, you know, treachery.
Or, you know, for Harry, he's probably thinking like, oh, Snape's trying to catch me. He's trying to get me in trouble. Because he's asking Filch to see if anybody's in the restricted section at night, which would be Harry. But we really know Snape is trying to catch Quirrell.
Quirrell, exactly.
So it's sort of interesting, like, the way Snape is really doing the right thing, but it can always come off so wrong.
He really is taking it upon himself to make sure that the stone is protected actively, because he does suspect Quirrell. I don't know if it excuses him abusing children.
And I wonder, you know, we're later going to find out the depths of the relationship between Dumbledore and Snape. So Harry takes off and he finds himself in basically a classroom. And we get this imagery of there being a magnificent mirror that goes all the way to the ceiling.
Number one piece of furniture from Hogwarts that I would love to have in my house, the Mirror of Erised. And maybe not with powers. The accompanying magical powers, but what a beautiful mirror.
But Harry gets a really interesting image. He looks in the mirror, and behind him, he sees a woman smiling and waving at him. And he reaches out as though to touch her, but she's not really there. And we know that she has dark red hair, and her eyes are just like Harry's. So that's Mama.
Oh, Lily.
And then his dad as well is there. And all of a sudden, there's all of these family members. He says, like, he could see their knobbly knees, which are just like his. And for the first time in his life, he felt like he had a family.
He gets to see his family. What a gift, though. Though the mirror certainly presents problems when Harry does sort of start getting lost and just always wanting to be in front of the mirror and like forgetting about his life to just live in this fantasy of what the mirror is showing him. We think of the Mirror of Erised with these very negative connotations because of Dumbledore's warning to him, but what a gift that he gets to see what his parents looked like, because until the end of the book, when Hagrid gives him the book with pictures, he doesn't know what his parents look like.
It's just interesting to think that he just has no idea, no concept of family. And apparently Petunia didn't look enough like him that he felt a strong, like, relational presence to her, you know?
Yeah, not to mention her treatment of him, you know?
Exactly. I think he was shocked, and a noise brings him kind of back to reality, and he goes back to the room where Ron is sleeping.
And he walks away going, wow, what a cool family-revealing mirror. It's going to show you your whole family. Yeah.
Which I think is just, it just shows, like, the innocence of youth.
The next night, he brings Ron after his first solo trip with his first joyride with the Invisibility Cloak. He goes, okay, now I'll share it with my friend. And he brings Ron. And Ron looks in the mirror and Harry goes, oh, do you see your family? And he goes, I'm holding the house cup. Ron's biggest desire, as we've like gleaned from previous chapters, is status. Like, Ron feels like he does not stand out in his family of, you know, seven kids. Ron just feels like he doesn't stand out among them. There's nothing special about him, and what his biggest desire is status. So of course the mirror is showing him winning every possible thing at Hogwarts.
I think it just shows an interesting dichotomy between Harry and Ron. Harry has the status and the money, but all he wants is a family. Mm-hmm. And Ron has the family, and all he wants is the status and the money, you know? Yeah. They really have the opportunity to give each other exactly what the other wants. And I think that Ron maybe doesn't understand how good he has it with his family.
The other sort of, each sort of provides the other with what they want.
Exactly.
Which is so nice.
Yeah.
Harry lingers in front of the mirror for a couple nights, and Ron's starting to notice, and he's like, shouldn't keep going back there just to see what the mirror has to show you, but Harry can think of nothing else, and who would blame him, you know? But there is one night where he goes back, and it's a little different, because who should be there but Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore. So he sits on the floor with Harry, which I think is so cute. And he talks to him about the mirror, tells him what it really does.
I love that Dumbledore knows, and your friend Ron himself is head boy. Harry says, how did you know? I don't need a cloak to become invisible.
And it's never mentioned again. That's literally never mentioned again. Just one of the mysteries of Dumbledore. And in their parting, Harry thinks to ask about Dumbledore and see, well, what do you see in the mirror, Professor? And he says, oh, you know, just a nice pair of wool socks. And then it says it wasn't until he got back in his dorm room that he thought Dumbledore might have been lying. And, you know, that made us all go, what does Dumbledore see in the mirror? In the second Fantastic Beasts movie, Crimes of Grindelwald, we see Dumbledore go to the mirror by himself. And who does he see? Gellert Grindelwald, his childhood love. We finally get to know 20 years later what Dumbledore sees in the mirror.
We're picking this up at chapter 13, Nicholas Flamel. I mean, surely somebody with a vested interest in the Quidditch game should not be allowed to referee.
Yeah. Why the hell is Snape refereeing a Quidditch game? Severus Snape strikes me as the least athletic person. But Albus Dumbledore would probably referee this Quidditch game better.
I don't think Snape's probably ever played Quidditch in his life.
No. He might have wanted to, but the fact that James Potter did it made him probably not want to at all. The trio assumes that he's got bad intentions, considering that they thought he was trying to kill Harry in the last Quidditch game. So there's this really funny little exchange where they find out that Snape's refereeing. And on page 217, it goes, "Don't play," said Hermione at once. "Say you're ill," said Ron. "Pretend to break your leg," Hermione suggested. "Really break your leg," said Ron. If they're like, this could not be any worse.
But of course, Snape has done it so that he can keep a closer eye on Harry. But I'm going to make a logical argument here that the best way to keep an eye on Harry would probably not be refereeing the match and would be watching from the sidelines.
Yeah, and it honestly, it's probably just to intimidate Quirrell. So we get the perspective from the stands rather than Harry out on the pitch. Before the match,
Neville gives Harry his card.
Yeah, after he's been bullied by Malfoy, and they're really sweet and they say, "You're worth 12 of Malfoy."
Yeah, very sweet. Throw Neville a little bone there. Yeah. They have an Albus Dumbledore card, and it talks about in the bio of the card.
Yeah, like the backside of the card with the little blurb.
Talks about how Dumbledore did work with the famous alchemist Nicholas Flamel. And of course, it's a light bulb moment for all of them. And Harry's like, oh, I have seen that name before.
Yeah. And Hermione's like, oh, he's an alchemist? Let me get this giant book that I checked out for a bit of light reading. You can't see, but I'm doing quote signs in the air. Light reading. And then they read through and discover that, you know, Flamel is the inventor of this thing called the Sorcerer's Stone. The Philosopher's Stone for literally everybody else except Americans. It also says in Flamel's bio that he's an alchemist and opera lover. As the resident opera singer on the podcast, I want you guys to know that if Nicholas Flamel is over 600 years old, he was there for the invention of opera.
Oh, I love that.
So he's like an OG opera fan.
Yeah, I love that for him.
Yeah.
So the Philosopher's Stone. The Philosopher's Stone is able to turn any metal into gold and can also produce the elixir of life that grants immortality.
So not only are they like,
Snape's trying to get the stone. Oh, crap. He's going to live forever if he gets the stone.
Yeah, that's their first inclination. They're just like, oh, Snape just wants this to produce the elixir of life
for himself.
There's this great quote on 221 where Harry is thinking and says, and yet sometimes he had the feeling that Snape could read minds.
Which Snape actually can read minds.
That's hilarious. That's a hilarious little Easter egg she put in there leading up to, you know, events in Order of the Phoenix.
Right. And he doesn't really, well, as far as we know, ever really use it other than a rudimentary sort of form. And to know when somebody is lying. Love that.
Yeah.
I think if I had, I always feel like I say this word wrong.
Occlumency?
Occlumency, thank you.
Or if you were a Legilimens?
If I was a Legilimens, how could you not use that all the time?
There's a part of Fantastic Beasts where Queenie was like in the middle of a city And she was getting really overwhelmed because she could hear people's thoughts. Like, for her, at least, sometimes she can't turn it off. But I wonder if there are people who can turn it off and on.
Snape can turn it off and on.
Yeah.
I think he's trained. That's basically chapter 13. It's Quidditch.
Wait, no.
Nothing really happens in the match. He just wins.
Okay.
He catches the snitch easily, and he wins because that's Harry. He's just winning. Harry follows Snape and Quirrell into the forest.
That's right. On his broom.
To overhear a little conversation. Which, why isn't Snape using the Muffliato? The spell?
Oh, yeah, the silencing charm?
Yeah. What's going on with that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you assume that if you go into the Forbidden Forest, your conversation is going to be in private, but I guess not. You're at risk of children overhearing you always. So, like,
is anyone safe with the Weasley brothers afoot?
Honestly, no. They made an extendable ear. No.
Exactly. We haven't really talked about it on the podcast. I would like to mention it.
What?
Aaron composed our theme music.
Oh, yeah, I did.
That's an original composition, obviously inspired by Harry Potter. But she did that her whole dang self. Well, and it was produced by Daniel Emmett.
He was a finalist on America's Got Talent. Amazing vocalist. My buddy from college. Love you, Dan. Thank you. He, like, produced it through his amazing computer samples.
Chapter 14. Norbert, the Norwegian Ridgeback.
So this kind of felt like, chapter 14 has always felt like filler to me a little bit, because it presents a problem that gets completely resolved within the chapter, but is like a segue into them having detention in the Forbidden Forest. The SparkNotes version, Hagrid gets a dragon egg off of somebody that he's met down at the pub. He's won it in a bet.
Down at the pub. Won it in a bet. I did.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Anyway, so Hagrid wins a dragon egg in a bet. The trio ends up finding out that he has this egg and is present for the hatching of the little dragon. Hagrid is super excited about it. He's like, oh, he knows. I think this is just a movie quote. I don't think this is in the book. I don't remember. But he says, oh, look, he knows his mommy.
So Hagrid names this dragon Norbert, but we later find out that Norbert's really Norberta. Female.
Oh my gosh, I forgot about that.
Yeah. Well, okay, another thing I have to say here is it's a little weird that Hagrid is like, hey, come to my hut. I have to show you this very against the rules thing I have going on.
Not just against the rules, like incredibly illegal in the wizarding world. Like dragon breeding is illegal.
Yeah, I mean, but doesn't he have some adult friends?
No.
That's pretty sad.
No, it's cute. He's like buddies with them. Also kind of weird if you think about it, but it's Hagrid, cute? So like it's fine. It's Hagrid.
I'm just saying it's like sad he doesn't have adult friends.
I guess you're right. But Dumbledore, but he's pretty busy.
Yeah, but do you really think they're friends?
No, I guess not. Do you think like Remus Lupin went down and like would have tea with Hagrid?
No, I don't think that at all.
I kind of wish he would have.
Yeah, it's a nice thought, but I don't think that's reality.
But you know what? If we think about it, like Hagrid, he got expelled his third year and then just sort of stayed around Hogwarts. So I think that might have stunted not only academically, but like mentally, maybe stunted his growth a little bit. I feel like he feels really, he's sort of got this like lovely childlike side of him. I feel like he feels this sort of kinship with the kids.
I know that he's the keeper of the grounds and all that jazz, but like, they couldn't just find a room for him in that huge castle so he could, you know, like, be amongst others. They had to just stick him
out. But he's outdoors.
He couldn't have, like a man cave tool shed he goes to, but get to sleep inside.
That's a good point.
I'm arguing for the mistreatment of Hagrid here. I think that he could have been...
That's a good point. More. If the castle was built in the 1000s or whatever, then there were not doorways and things built really big enough for Hagrid. So like maybe the hallways have high arches, but probably the doorway into chambers certainly don't. But they're also wizards, so.
Right, and he does go to the feast in the Great Hall.
He's a little all.
Right, but that's the only time we really see him in the castle.
Yeah, I guess you're right. That's interesting.
It's sad. He just has to live out there. It's probably cold out there. I mean, he has a little fireplace. Also,
anyway, chapter 14 just is like SparkNotes version. Hagrid gets a dragon. Hatches the dragon, somebody finds out about said dragon, and Harry and Hermione and Ron offer to have Ron's older brother Charlie take the dragon off Hagrid's hands and bring him to Romania where he can like be a proper dragon. But in the process of that, Ron gets bitten, has to go to the hospital wing to treat the venom. And so Harry and Hermione sneak up to the astronomy tower one night in under Harry's cloak, and they get Charlie Weasley's friends to come pick up this dragon, who, by the way, Hagrid has packed a teddy bear for. Adorable, already crying. And Charlie Weasley's friends pick up this dragon, and in the process of coming back to the common room in their dormitories, Harry and Hermione leave the invisibility cloak up on the astronomy tower, and they get caught by Filch. Womp womp.
Womp womp.
And that's the chapter, basically.
As we transition into chapter 15, everybody hates Harry and the trio for losing all of the house points. And this is going to be sort of a running theme of the books, that people at Hogwarts sort of dislike or hate Harry for some reason. It comes up a lot. It comes up in Goblet of Fire again. It comes up in Order of the Phoenix.
Harry, you know, tends to get himself into trouble, and sometimes that can penalize his house. I feel like it like happens in phases. Either people are like, our house has the boy who lived, or he does something wrong, and then they're like, how dare he? Dumbledore was talking about how the Forbidden Forest is off limits, and yet it seems like the perfect place to send children into for detention.
Oh, there's no safer place but Hogwarts, except maybe Gringotts.
Neither of those places are safe.
Yeah, the track record for those places, not good.
Not great. So they are sentenced to detention in the Forbidden Forest, and Malfoy comes along.
Draco.
Oh, Draco. And yeah, not the place I'd want to serve. Well, actually, I don't know. I might like the Forbidden Forest.
It's sort of weird that the punishment for being out late at night is to go on a detention that occurs at 11 p.m.
Sorry. They're in the Forbidden Forest, and they are looking for an injured unicorn, because Hagrid found a dead unicorn recently, and he has seen some more unicorn blood around, and they're trying to find this injured unicorn.
Harry, Fang, and Malfoy find it, but they are confronted by a hooded figure, and then saved by Firenze.
Firenze. There's a lot more centaur content in the books as well, so they meet in total three centaurs tonight.
Centaurs are very mystical.
Yeah, they're cool. I love the centaurs. They have detention in the Forbidden Forest. Voldemort's there, or like Quirrell, but also Voldemort. I think it's Quirrell with Voldemort on the back of his head. Oh, one important thing that they sort of figure out after this is they, you know, at first they thought, oh, Snape is just trying to steal the stone for himself. And then after this encounter with who they figure out is Voldemort, they are like, oh, crap. No, Snape is trying to steal the stone to bring back the literal Dark Lord who murdered Harry's parents. This is a problem. In fact, more problematic than we originally thought. You know,
this is interesting to me, because this is, again, this idea that Snape is working with Voldemort is going to come up to Harry. Like, he's going to be very much suspicious of this the whole time. And this book is like a microcosm of Snape's story within the whole series, where Harry believes he's working for Voldemort, but in the end, Snape's been working for good the whole time.
Yeah.
Little connection point.
Snape's been working for Snape, but you know, whatever. Uh-oh, McKenna made a face at me.
We can debate this at a later time.
I have some thoughts about Snape that we can discuss at a later date.
I'm not saying he's perfect.
No, and I know you don't think that. You're intelligent.
But I love his troubled...
You just love troubled bad. Chapter 16, through the trap door, we find out there's a giant squid in the lake. That's the first note I wrote.
Yeah, I wish we had seen the squid in Goblet of Fire.
Yeah, me too.
That would have been a challenge.
That would have been cool. Yeah, that's true. Why didn't they incorporate...
mermaids that did nothing? Let's get the squid in here.
Let's talk about that when we get there. That's a hilarious idea. So Harry's like trying to warn everybody that something's off, and nobody is regarding Harry's warning. Surprise, shock. And
he's also having some issues with his scar. It's exam time, end of the year. And he's becoming distracted by dreams and his scar. And he's having dreams of a bright flashing green light. And Harry's relationship to his scar and how it warns him of imminent danger is going to just continue to evolve.
Yeah. And continue to be important. Totally.
And then he has an epiphany.
Which is?
That the person who gave Hagrid his dragon could be after the stone.
Yes.
What a conclusion to draw.
Didn't Hagrid mention, like, oh, they were asking me about... that's what happens later.
About Fluffy.
Yeah. They were asking Hagrid about Fluffy, seemed very interested in Fluffy, wanted to know about Fluffy. how to specifically put Fluffy to sleep. Do you think Dumbledore knows what's going on? Do you think Dumbledore is like...
Yes. Yes, I do, because he gets the cloak back at the end of the last chapter. Like, yeah. The note, just in case. Who do you think planted that? Dumbledore. If we want to talk about problematic characters, and I'm not saying Snape is not problematic.
Oh, Dumbledore is incredibly problematic.
Yeah. What is he doing with these literal children?
Putting them in danger. And he's all cute and quirky, so people are like, oh, Dumbledore, sweet old man. Dumbledore's not a sweet old man.
No, he's not, and he's had a problematic past with his sister, his relationship with his brother, his relationship to Grindelwald. He has a problematic past, and then he's supposed to be the most powerful wizard ever, especially alive, definitely the most powerful wizard alive, and he's having these children doing his bidding for him.
Yeah. It's like weird. He be the one it's like weird obstacle course training.
Yes,
it's for the future, because he knows what's going to happen. I'm like, wasn't Dumbledore like privy to the fact that Lockhart is an absolute buffoon? Like, why would you hire that man at your hiring a teacher just to out him as a fool seems a little extreme.
Why didn't Dumbledore go into the Chamber of Secrets?
That's a great question. It's like all of these things are like weird. Like Harry's in his own like long run. Triwizard tournament, except it's mono wizard tournament, and it's like training him to defeat Voldemort. He like gets a little puzzle at the end of each school year,
but it's just never enough, and then Dumbledore dies and Harry's basically just like left to figure it out.
Yeah,
these are things as an adult that are just very upsetting. So the trio puts us all together that Fluffy's guarding the stone, that Snape wants the stone for Voldemort, and they have to go protect the stone. And they try to go to McGonagall. And
everybody brushes them off.
Yeah, she's like, I help protect the stone. It's fine, you idiot children. Like, yeah. Thank you. And then Harry decides and makes the decision that he's going to go save the stone. And what is interesting here is that Harry does really know what's at stake, because if he gets expelled for doing this, he's going to have to go live with the Dursleys for the rest of his life.
But that's what makes Harry admirable, even as an 11-year-old. Like, he's a kid. What's always made him admirable is, like, yes, he breaks the rules. Like, he's a troublemaker a little bit. But most of the time, if he's breaking a rule, he's doing it for a noble cause. They encounter Neville on their way sneaking out of the common room. I love this exchange.
He always finds his bravery and his courage when he needs it the most. And it's just so nice to see those reminders of truly why Neville was sorted into Gryffindor. So, poor Neville. He gets
petrified.
And then they get to the trap door. Mm-hmm. And they go in. So they encounter Fluffy.
Fluffy's already asleep, which means supposedly Snape has already gone through this sort of task to get to the stone.
The next task that they're going to encounter, or obstacle really, is the Devil's Snare.
Yes, which is from Professor Sprout.
Yes, Devil's Snare is going to come up again in the series. It's later going to be used by the Death Eaters in Order of the Phoenix to kill Broderick Bode, and it's also going to be used in Defense of Hogwarts and Deathly Hallows.
Interesting. I forgot about Broderick Bode.
Yeah, so we're going to see Devil's Snare again. And I love... Hermione can name Devil's Snare, and she knows what it is, and she says something to the effect of, the fire is how you get the Devil's Snare to release you, but I don't have any matches, like, how am I going to make a fire? And Ron says to her, are you a witch or not? Which is really sweet. There's another moment in Deathly Hallows as well, which obviously we'll get to all these things, but when I find connections, I like to highlight them, where Hermione says it back to Ron. She says, are you a wizard or not, when they're trying to freeze the Whomping Willow.
Oh, what a cute long-term little Easter egg. I love that nugget.
You love a nugget.
Yeah. And
the third task is
the chamber with what they think are a bunch of birds.
But they're really flying keys.
Upon closer look, they're flying keys. This is Professor Flitwick's sort of task that he's set up. And there are three broomsticks in here. They all get on a broomstick and they're like, how are we going to find this key? And they find that there's a key with a dented wing, which means that, again, they think Professor Snape has already gone through here and he must have used that key. The next one is the wizard's chess board.
It's sort of interesting because there's a task in here for everyone. Ron really has the opportunity to step up here for Wizard's Chest. And as we found out during the Christmas chapters, Ron is excellent at Wizard's Chess. It's something he excels at. And he's taught Harry how to play Wizard's Chess, which of course is much more violent. And
way chess. More violent. No safer place than Hogwarts. You realize towards the end of the game when they're playing that Ron has set it up where he needs to sacrifice himself in order for them to get to the next task. And he does so willingly.
So I just have a couple of things on the chessboard that we can discuss. Firstly, I'm going to link it in the show notes, but I have this awesome write-up that a chess professional wrote about how this game could have possibly gone versus the way that it went in the books. And the
That is so cool.
So any chess nerds out there, I'm not going to recount it, but I will just link the article. It's very cool.
That is so cool. I love that you found that.
And then I was also reading in my preparation for this episode that there were a lot of theories before Deathly Hallows came out that the chess game had great significance within the series, that Ron was going to die in the final book. Obviously, that proves to be untrue, but that was a really big fandom theory for a long time before we got the conclusion to the series.
Interesting.
Ron sacrifices himself, his knight gets taken out so that Hermione and Harry can move on. And he says, that's chess. You've got to make sacrifices, which maybe that's Dumbledore's motto. You know, like Half-Blood Prince, he sacrifices himself. Like, that's chess. You got to make sacrifices.
He's sacrificing Harry for 7 whole years.
Basically. Right. And what is the series really, this story, if not kind of a big game of chess? Like, you make a move, I make a move. Yeah. So I do think the chessboard has a lot of significance here.
They get to the next task. This is Snape's task. And it's, there are 7 potions laid out on a table, and you have to basically answer a riddle to be able to get through. Oh, I'm sorry. Did they encounter the trolls already, or is that after?
Oh, I always forget about the trolls because we don't.
Yeah, so Quirrell, I forget which one comes first, but both Quirrell and the rest of the tasks, the last two, are from Quirrell and Snape. There's a room of trolls. They've already been knocked out. The trolls were contributed by Quirrell. And then the next room, they're already knocked out, so Harry and Hermione, Ron is, like, passed out after the chess game, so Harry and Hermione go on. And the next task after that is there's a room, a table with 7 potions, and a logic question. It's a riddle. And that was contributed by Professor Snape. Hermione solves the riddle. There are, you know, there are 3 things of poison, and then 2 things are just tonic wine, and then there are 2 smaller potions, and 1 will get you through this fire that'll lead you into the chamber where the stone is, and then the other will get you through this other fire that'll lead you back if you want to turn back. So Hermione takes the one that'll turn back, Harry takes the one that'll lead him to where the stone is, and what's sweet is you get this little exchange where Harry's like, I'm not as good as you. You're really brilliant. And she's like, yeah, but you have some qualities that are really, really important, like bravery. And
yeah, she says, what smarts when you are like loyal and brave? Oh, it's so good. And it reminds me of when Hermione says goodbye to Harry before he goes to die in the Forbidden Forest.
Yes.
They're such an endearing pair of friends.
And he goes into the next chamber. And I'm trying to recall, this leads us to chapter 17, which is the man with 2 faces.
There is one more task. The 7th task is the Mirror of Erised.
Yes.
And
it is. It really is a task.
It is a task. And that's set up by Dumbledore. And it's meant that only the pure of heart is going to be able to look into the Mirror of Erised and see the stone.
And get it. Somebody who wanted to find it but not use it for themselves.
Right. And
yeah.
This is an example, and I think it's sort of overlooked, of what a brilliant wizard Dumbledore is. Because in theory, that would keep so many people out. If you're
at least anybody who like wanted to get it for malicious reasons.
Right, because the only reason you're really going down there, likely, is to get it to use it.
Yeah.
And so Harry goes down there.
You're right, that is quite brilliant.
Rescue it.
Yeah.
But not to use it. And it's interesting because Harry's already looked into the Mirror of Erised and he's seen his parents and he knows, you know what I mean? Like he knows the stone has these powers of immortality. And like that has to be tempting in a way, especially when you've just experienced so much death in your young lifetime to think like, oh, I will never die. I'll never meet that fate. Like my parents have met that fate. You know, it just shows he's so strong even at 11 years old. that he really goes down there with the purest of hearts, and it's not at all about getting the stone for his own gain.
Or glory.
Or glory, yeah.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. So, yeah, he goes in there. We see Quirrell, and he's, like, confused, because he's like, no, it shouldn't be you, it should be Snape. And then Quirrell explains to him, like, no, it's been me all along. The stuttering was an act. I'm working for the Dark Lord. Actually, he's on the back of my head, in fact. Thank you for saying that.
Did we say the chapter's called The Man with Two Faces?
Yes.
So that obviously alludes to what we're finding out about Quirrell and Voldemort, mm-hmm. Two Faces. Yeah. I also think that it has sort of a hat tip to Snape, too, who Harry goes down there fully expecting to see. And Snape is also kind of the man with two faces. He has both sides to him.
That is very interesting.
I'm not trying to make everything about Snape, but I do think
That's a really good point. I didn't even think about that. I want to address one thing. There's some speculation as to whether or not the sort of attachment of Voldemort to Quirrell is a Horcrux. It is definitively not. I was also confused about this, did some research, not a Horcrux. Because he didn't have to split his soul in order to get there. He just sort of attached himself to him.
And he didn't attach himself until after the robbery, the break-in at Gringotts,
right.
In which Quirrell failed to get the stone.
Right.
And at that point, Voldemort felt that he couldn't trust Quirrell on his own.
He reveals Voldemort under his turban. Voldemort isn't buying this, like, dumb act that, like, Harry doesn't know where the stone is, because the stone has materialized in Harry's pocket when he looked into the mirror. Yeah. So, events occur. Voldemort says, get him. Quirrell goes to grab Harry and, again, gets Thanos-level dusted. I have a question about the limitations of this old magic.
Okay, I was literally
being able to be protected by somebody who has been sacrificed themselves for you.
So one of my questions I have written down is, if Quirrell had tried to curse Harry, would it have rebounded?
Interesting. And, like, the other thing is, like, the conclusion I've drawn is, like, how long does Harry get to be protected by his mother's love, by that old magic which protected him as a baby? Because it has come up again when Quirrell tries to touch him, he turns to dust. And it is...
Love that.
It's, yeah, we love that. We love...
I wish in coronavirus times that would happen to me. Like, people get within my 6 feet bubble and they just turn to dust.
That...
I'm going to need Dr. Fauci to work on that.
That was such a Slytherin thing to say.
Respect the 6 feet, okay?
True. But what was I going to say? Oh, like, what are the limitations on this magic where you get protected if somebody sacrifices themselves for you? Because it protected Harry as a baby. It has protected him again with Quirrell. But in Goblet of Fire, where they're in the graveyard, Voldemort comes right up and puts his little finger on his forehead.
Right.
So I think maybe the conclusion I've come to is, maybe because Voldemort's reborn, the magic, like, does not apply to him anymore, not in his, like, reborn state. And then, like what are the limitations on that? Is it just anybody, or is this specifically magic against Voldemort? You know?
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm going to do some research.
It's too vague. This magic is too vague. He's in the hospital wing.
And he's in the hospital wing. And Albus is there.
And they sort of have this little debrief of Albus's little puzzle that he set up for Harry. And, you know.
So Dumbledore says a lot of things here that's very interesting. He tells us, well, Harry says, you know who. And Dumbledore says, he tried to kill you. You should call him Voldemort.
The quote is, fear of a name increases fear of the thing itself. Which is why he's always advocated for everybody to call Tom Riddle Voldemort rather than he who must not be named. Another quote that I love from this little exchange when Harry's in the hospital wing is on page 297, after all, to the well-organized mind, death is but the next great adventure. We can look back at this when we're talking about the fan theory that Dumbledore actually is the character or sort of the representation of death in the story.
I agree. And I think that this quote hits on a major theme of the entire series, which is that death is nothing to be scared of. We can embrace it and move on to,
mm-hmm.
which for the author, she who must not be named, it's sort of interesting to introduce death to children
yeah.
and to talk about it, because death is something that I think I mean, I don't have kids, but I can imagine has to be a very hard thing to talk to children about and to explain it.
We get on 301, we get our alas earwax line, that iconic line when he eats the birdie bots.
And
it's the end of the year. They have the feast.
It is the feast. Hagrid promises he's never going to drink again.
Oh, he tells too many secrets when he drinks.
Oh, Rubius.
Slytherin is set to win the house cup, but at the last second, as we mentioned earlier,
Gryffindor pulls through.
Dumbledore doles out a bunch of points to Harry, Ron, and Hermione for their experience going down to save the stone, as well as Neville. Neville for his bravery for standing up to his friends. And Gryffindor ends up winning the house cup. Hagrid presents Harry with a photo album. He's like made it his mission to reach out to former friends of James and Lily. So he gets to see what they look like for the first time, which is so sweet and, you know, kind of Hagrid. The book caps off with Harry being like, I'm sure it'll be a much more normal year next year. He sort of finishes every year thinking, well, at least next year is going to be normal and better. And alas, they are not. But poor kid. Your ending thoughts on having reread Sorcerer's Stone, like your debrief on rereading the first novel.
Okay, so I went into this thinking, just like 100% honesty, that the real meat and bones of what we're going to talk about is going to start at book 3.
Yeah.
And I still believe that's true.
Yeah.
However, I've thoroughly enjoyed rereading Sorcerer's Stone from an adult lens and getting to really think about all the connection points that there are in this book to more important themes that happen later in the series. Okay, so I have one final question for you.
Yes.
When you eventually one day introduce this book to your children,
yes,
what are the key lessons or themes you hope they get out of it?
That's a really great question. The importance of serving and caring for others, I would think. That's the first thing that came to mind. And the importance of like how important your love can be to somebody who maybe has not known a good love in their life, not even romantic love, just like friendship and, you know, kindness, and how important it is to show that to everybody, no matter where they come from.
Yeah, I love that.
How about you?
I think kind of along the same vein, the importance of friendship and that family is really who you decide it is and not what you're born into. And that death and hardship and the unknowns are very scary things, and it's much easier to walk into those parts of life when you have friends by your side. Hey, thanks for listening to our latest episode. As always, please subscribe on whatever podcast platform you're listening on. And if you're not a listener on Apple Podcasts, it would still help us out a lot if you head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star review. If you have any questions, comments, concerns about anything you heard in this episode today, please drop us a line at our Anchor profile. You can leave us a nifty little voice message there, or you can head to our Instagram @thedailyprofcast to DM us or leave us an email.